I have this really great friend who's a nun up in Gampo Abbey, and her life is pretty sweet right now. You know, she has her own little meditation cabin, and she has lots of young people who are visiting her, and she has a lovely life, but she knows she's not enlightened yet, and she knows she's getting near death. She's on the oxygen, and she has, you know, many, many health problems. She's near death, but she's not enlightened. So she wants to get angry a few more times, because then she can practice this practice, and it's so helpful. So, yes. So her favorite thing is when the squirrels try to steal the bird seed, because that's the last thing around that will make her angry. She's narrowed it down to those kinds of things. She goes, "Oh, how wonderful, my teacher, squirrel, you're here again today." You know, you think it's funny, but after a while, that you know, you get calmer and calmer. They say that the old meditation masters, they want to check on their students, so they'd hire the neighborhood kids to go throw rocks at them. So then they'd get reports back of who jumped up and got mad, or who threw the rocks bad, or who yelled at the kids. So everything in your life, all the events of your day, it becomes like this opportunity to see what happens with curiosity and friendliness, as opposed to they're out to get me and it's going to happen again, right? And then the final part is paying attention to that open space. So when you let things run their course, and when you experience just for a moment that open freedom in your mind, when the energy is gone and the storyline is gone and there's this just fresh air, we can rest there. We can rest in that space. So that would be where contentment is and where peace of mind is and where actual happiness is. That open clarity, freshness, expansiveness in your mind that's so different from feeling trapped in your emotions, trapped by situations, trapped in some sort of suffering. Yeah?
Are you taking questions?
Mm-hmm.
What is, from this perspective, what is your perspective on emotions, strong emotions that are painful, that might be healthy to go through? In other words, healthy not to change a storyline on. For example, you're a parent and your child dies. And a lot of the research says, you know, if you don't go through these stages, that, you know, it's not healthy.
It's actually just the same. Because you go through the stages. Something like that isn't going to take just one sitting. It doesn't disappear the first time you practice with it. So if you think of a death and grief, actually feeling the feelings is the hardest part to do. And so just dropping the storyline so you can feel the feeling in your body is actually... Most times you're scared to allow yourself to get to that point. And the story will come back again, over and over again. But I know that my brother was killed. You know, so I watched my mother be trapped by that for the rest of her life. Because she didn't have a way to move out of the story at all. She was only trapped in telling herself that story over and over and over again. So experiment with it, and it's not that, you know, Mara comes back over and over again to have tea. And so, you know, finally, you know, that very painful situation, there it is again. Can I breathe? Can I relax? Can I drop the story and feel the feeling? Yeah. It's more the different kinds of intensities that we tell the story that that keeps us from moving through the situation onto the life again.
So in that example, what was the storyline then?
Well, it could be very individual. I could say in my family, it was my son was killed, and my son was murdered, and the person who did it, they should be in jail forever, and you know, the story just expands and expands and expands. I can't accept that this happened. Somewhere I wasn't a good mother, those kinds of things. And so I would say in a situation like that, I know what I had to work through personally was just allowing myself to experience the fact that someone I love died, and feeling those feelings, and then allowing myself to generate a connection towards the person who committed the murder, so I could see that this was someone who was a human being, who had a perfect part of them, who reached a stage of hurt that they did this action. So, you know, all these things are complex, so one practice doesn't just solve all of the problems and all the difficulties. You combine it with compassion practices and other kinds of practices.
So the storyline then is anything that I make up that's outside of the facts.
Yeah. Yeah. And most of the time, what we think of are facts are things we make up. That's why I was going back to that very initial, just the basic underlayer of anxiety and uncertainty. And if you think of it relative to addictions, it's very similar in that not accepting that this is present. We want to go towards something that relieves us of it, as opposed to relaxing, opening to it. And one of the interesting things about Buddhism, it has many teachings from many different kinds of perspectives. So one of the other perspectives about this basic anxiety or uncertainty or dissatisfaction is actually that this is a part of your Buddha nature, knowing that peace is possible. So a dissatisfaction with this experience of ordinary suffering and ordinary reality, knowing that an impulse towards finding where peace of mind might be. Yeah.
With further practice or with enlightenment, does the energy of emotion ever not come up? Is it all peace and harmony, or you know, if once you reach the point where you no longer generate story?
What's interesting, it's really hard to say what enlightenment actually is. But what we can say, actually, it's so great that you're here with Isaac. So what they say is, if you want to know what enlightenment is, essentially it's when you see a gorgeous little baby like Isaac, and your heart just opens in love. No. Look at him. So essentially, is enlightenment is that
talk about teachers.
is the love that you have that just naturally opens, and seeing with great compassion that all of these beloved beings are suffering because they're in a little nightmare and you just want to wake them up. So you have the joy of that love as well as the impulse to go, honey, you know, wake up. Everything's wonderful. Yeah.
My name is Beth. One of the antagonists to acceptance is, for me, is that, well, if you're accepting everything, then that's one of the ways that I can allow harm to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to ask you to speak a little more on the distinction between the storyline and decision making. That decision can be made without the story. So for myself, I had a partner who was a very unhealthy partner for myself, and I had a story about that. They had a bad childhood, and that's why, et cetera, et cetera, or I need to help them, or there's all this story that came up. But just because I had a story doesn't mean I didn't need to make a decision.
You're right. Yes, of course. Thank you so much, because I often forget to say that. It doesn't mean that you stay in a situation that's abusive by any means. It just means, what do you do with your own mind? So, it's certainly clear that anyone inflicting harm, you know, the skillful means is to stop the harm or move out of the way of the harm, because you're getting injury and you're allowing somebody else to create more karma for themselves. So absolutely. However, recovering from that, you know, you've moved, you're in a different situation. Do you want to carry that injury over and over and over again in your brain? So that's when it would be useful to say, I'm going to not replay that tape over and over. I'm going to look at what happens when I just allow that storyline to run its course and have the openness. Because I think in these situations, for instance, if someone's telling you you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, which sometimes happens in abusive situations, somewhere you're starting to carry I'm bad, or I'm always misinterpreted, or I'm this or I'm that, as opposed to, you know, I am this fresh, open space. You know, and other people's perceptions are not, that's not real. I am this fresh, open space. Yeah, so it's really important not to confuse action with working in meditation with your own emotions.
Mm-hmm. I tend to repress my emotions through mm-hmm. my fear of anger.
Yeah.
So I will not, it'll be there. I'm really not aware of it. I don't acknowledge it.
Yeah.
I just feel sort of dead inside.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, somehow I have to get in touch with it in order to be able to look at the storyline and all that.
Yeah. I thought when I became a nun, I really thought I had to be overnight, I had to be perfect, and I couldn't be angry ever again. That would be a bad nun to be angry at. You know, it seems funny now. So clearly impossible, it seems funny now. So so this is exactly the stage when I first got these instructions, and I was really getting into trouble because I was repressing things. This is the opposite of repressing, because you're actually feeling the feelings, and you're, and it is a little scary, because you might be very angry and you might not know what that actually is like. But that's why it said it's courageous just to test it for a minute. So by allowing yourself to feel the energy in your body, that's actually feeling it, not repressing it. So you know, I really invite you to just test it for a minute. Something makes you angry. So instead of, you know, saying, you know, it's gone, I'm not going to touch it, I'm going to block that off. The instructions I know are so simple sounding, but it's very, very difficult to do. And if I think about, now I have much more of a habit of doing it, but when I think of going back to the first time I tried it, it was, you know, it's taken years for it to be a something that I apply on a regular basis. It was very scary at first. Yeah.
In my family of origin, it was always count to 10.
It was, count to 10. Yeah. Well,
that's shorter than a minute.
Yeah.
It's a start.
Yeah. So when I was thinking about this, you know, I think, we really in our culture have some techniques like that. Like moms are doing time out with kids, you know, and sometimes we have similar techniques. And this is just bringing them consciously to the surface, saying, I'm going to interrupt the pattern. It could be by counting to 10. It could be by, I use the circumambulating the stupa.
Oh, lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, then you're doing something virtuous at the same time.
I think that sometimes doing something that's in your family that's meant to keep you from going somewhere, it oftentimes causes the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
Because in changing the pattern, it's like counting to 10, maybe like this frantic, like, I gotta come to 10.
Yeah.
And that makes you even more anxious. Whereas
yeah.
if you instead figured out a different way, that's something sort of noticed.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about being curious. You'll see what works for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for somebody, it might be a fresh instruction. For somebody else, it's like mom telling me yet again, and it's my trigger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mean that about. One of the things that I really love about my teacher, Venerable Dahani, it's hard for me to get used to this because I don't know why it seems like scary instructions, but her thought is, you know, we're meant to be adventurous and playful in our lives and to explore things with curiosity. So that's, you know, that you know, of course we can be serious about things, but we can also start to integrate that this is something that we can just explore. What makes us angry? What makes, you know, some people, I mean, everybody's favorite, they're the top five, and each one has we even have Buddha families that are based on a tendency towards one of the emotions. You know, so somebody else's might be jealousy, and I've talked to friends who, you know, it's just ruining their lives to have a feeling of jealousy. You know, other people, it's something else. But what's interesting, I don't know if we have any of the tankas here, but in the Vajrayana, you see these very strange-looking tankas where somebody will be wearing skulls on their head. You go, oh, what's going on here? That's a really strange-looking thing. But they represent these five painful emotions, and that by investigating them, now they're the jewels that become their crown. Because through these things, they've discovered their wisdom. Yeah, by fully going into them. Yeah?
The different forms of anger we talked about before were almost all expressed outward road rage. So if depression is anger directed inward, are there any distinctive differences between depression and some of those other forms of anger in terms of how we handle it or observe it and deal with it, since it isn't inward?
Yes, I think, you know, that is true. And I think if we investigate it, it'd be similar. Depression still is connected to a storyline of I'm less than in some way. And it's actually considered pride, in that it's an intense self-focus, in the same way pride is an intense self-focus. And so it's still the same instruction. Look at the storyline and feel the energy. But I'll think about that one some more because it is slightly different, and I'll start experimenting with it. It's on my list. Yeah.
How does this emotional practice relate to ideas of self-esteem?
Ideas of self-esteem. I think that's connected to what our friend here was asking. Can you be more specific in terms of your question?
It sounded like the being friendly to yourself and being curious sounds like ideas of having a love for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
And so it seems like a way of cultivating self-esteem,
mm-hmm.
and then using that to bring it out into the world.
Mm-hmm. That would be true. Yeah. It's certainly the view in Buddhism, which I really like, and I've been hearing from not only the Tibetan teachers, but from Pema Chodron, who teaches so widely, you know, that this quality of self-hatred is something that we in the West are experts in a way that other cultures aren't. That we can hear something wonderful and we can say, I can't do that, so there's something wrong with me. instead of other cultures will say, I can't do that, I can train in these ways that lead to it. They don't put that extra little block of there's something wrong with me. And the view of Buddhism, which is so interesting, which is the considered the antidote to that particular kind of a block, is that every single being that's alive, not just human beings, every animal, every insect, has the exact same Buddha nature and Buddha potential. So we see some of the great people like, this is Chicago, so I really love Oprah Winfrey. I just think she's one of the world's bodhisattvas. Every single person has the capacity to be as open-hearted and as loving as the Dalai Lama and Oprah Winfrey. We all have that capacity. And it's a matter of training our hearts and minds to grow into remembering that that's the full capacity. So a lot of Buddhism is understanding that there's the beings are perfect and that they're covered over with these layers of emotional, destructive emotions and other kinds of illusory states. And that by working through that, you uncover the perfect natural state. So that's the a view that's very, very helpful. And in terms of self-esteem, when you start to see all the different kinds of stories that you tell yourself, you start to see that they're all just things I'm making up. And when you contrast that with the open-minded state, you start to see the difference. Now, this open-minded state, we were talking about it in the context of seeing it when everything releases, but there are other kinds of situations that you can remember and touch base with. And especially for today, one of the common situations that everybody has experienced, or almost everybody, is a car accident. So you're sliding on the ice and your car spins, you know, and then it smacks. For a minute, your mind is open and fresh. Just for a half a second, then everything floods in. But there's that half a second that it's open. And so some kind of a shock can allow, you know how it's like everything stops, time stops, and then all of your concerns flood in. So there are many different kinds of ordinary experiences that help us see that our capacity is this large experience. Our capacity is this vast open mind. In the same way, when we see Isaac, we remember that our capacity is this vast open heart. Yeah?
Something you said triggered something for me, so I have a question. When you said all sentient beings have a Buddha nature,
mm-hmm.
So can animals be enlightened?
Mm-hmm.
They can reach enlightenment.
Well, and some, in our sense of things, some great Buddhas would deliberately take incarnation as animals in order to help beings.
I'm sorry, my dog Boomer.
Yeah.
With I always view anger, letting anger out as energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid if I can become open, I'll just become very passive. And just sort of look and smooth and quiet, but not living, not functioning.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's often a misconception, and the experience, not being enlightened, I can't say for sure, but what people have described is that each moment is like the first direct experience. And we almost have nothing that's a direct experience. But Trungpa Rinpoche says, like, imagine the first time you heard a trumpet. And, oh, I know, I was in the woods in Europe, and someone took me to, it was the season when the deer mate, and they said, oh, this is extraordinary, you have to come listen. And there was this sound I had never heard before, so I didn't have any associations. So it's hard for, that is a recent experience I've had of something that I've never experienced before. So there's a direct freshness that's very alive, not a deadness. Yeah.
I do think this is our Western thing that we, if we actually release our strong emotions, we'll be passive. I mean, that's our, I think that's our story, you know?
Yeah.
And so I love being with you. Just the way your laughter bubbles up, or just the way, you know, that thought of if we didn't have all this, maybe we could really act more freely rather than passively. You know, it's just not our way of viewing, I think.
Well, and especially if you're not caught up in the emotions, you have the choice of finding some skill somewhere, like if you wanted to diffuse a fight. You know, if you weren't caught up with it, you could at least have the potential of finding what would be the skillful means to diffuse it. Yeah.
Just to speak to this from my own experience, I know that I'm often making decisions now so that I later won't have to make a decision because I'm afraid about it later. So I would, in a similar situation, you know, well, I don't want to be, you know, not having a storyline because then I'll be passive. Because I'm worried that being passive or something isn't good or something like that. But I have a judgment now about it. But I know that I then will have full capacity to make a choice at that time. So I don't need to worry now about me later because I'm going to be my same, you know, I'm going to have my divinity and my compassion and myself then. I don't need to control it now. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's a way of just worrying and being afraid. But I don't have to be afraid because I will be able to, I will have all the capacities that I have now, probably more later at that time.
Well, the purpose of getting enlightened is so that you can benefit beings. So you do have the capacity to then see what will benefit everybody in this situation. And as you get closer and closer to enlightenment, you have more skills. And because you've worked through it yourself and you've gotten to know yourself, you know the range of thoughts and feelings, you know, and you're also listening and observing to all the different kinds of people. So then you are led to a greater experience and greater skill.
Mm-hmm. I have input on the depression. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that I could do the same thing with anger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty amazed, actually. I've suffered with depression for a long time to the point of hospitalization.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard about the patterns get stronger and stronger as you go over them in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd had therapy and all this stuff and realized that I needed to stop thinking about things in the same way. When mm-hmm. you're depressed, there's a few things that happen, for me anyway. One is the thing that triggers the depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that terrible feeling gets fed by two things. One, the story constantly being repeated,
mm-hmm.
and then me focusing on the feeling that I have. Oh, God, mm-hmm. I feel so bad. I mean, so I feel so bad, the story gets fed. Oh, I mean, it just turns into this horrible thing.
Yes.
So I stopped the story.
Mm-hmm.
I would stop it. My mother died terribly. And so mm-hmm. when I start thinking about that, I go, nope, I can't go there. The feeling doesn't disappear right away,
mm-hmm.
but I stop feeding the story. I stop mm-hmm. sinking in the pain,
mm-hmm.
and eventually it does pass.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten a lot better. I'm not on medication mm-hmm. or anything like that. So I think my patterns, my thought processes, my storylines, which I never even thought of until now,
mm-hmm.
I stopped the story on both levels, the emotional
mm-hmm.
feeding of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the flame you were talking about. It does eventually just die
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't keep you from feeling the feeling.
Exactly.
But it doesn't feed them.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah.
And I don't know if this is a comment or a question. I recently went through like a 6 to 8 week depression. And it was very, you know, and I was very aware of the fact that, okay, you know, I have some stories and I have to...
Well, would you speak up?
Sure. I recently went through like a 6 to 8 week depression and I've been coming out of it slowly. I got on St. John's wort.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm a mother to a young child. I, you know, lack sleep frequently. We moved. You know, there were a lot of like physical stressors.
Yeah.
And so my question slash comment is about just being compassionate. There are biochemical
mm-hmm.
causes for these things, and we can make them worse by our stories. But it's
mm-hmm.
not always, like, it's not always bad thinking
mm-hmm.
that causes
mm-hmm.
the feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's not that there aren't realistic decisions that you can't analyze and say this needs to change or that needs to change, or I see that this... But the connection we make, it's because that we create the story around.
And we can definitely get stuck.
That part we can.
Yeah, we get stuck can because
change.
Of the stories.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Perpetuate it.
Yeah.
Was the term Shempa connected to the four difficulties?
Shempa is that underlying anxiety that all humans share. That is sort of nameless and formless, and it's the underlying feeling that we want to escape, that starts leading out to generating one of the emotions.
And was that the four difficulties to doing this kind of work? You said were one that there was a self or no self, or that conception. Then another was fear of dying.
Oh, you're great. You remember things
like
that.
Well, I'm trying to remember them because those were the hard parts for me.
They're the maras. You're remembering the maras. So there
were
four
maras
and four difficulties.
Can you go over those again?
Yeah, I love it. Tibetans are so good. They list everything.
I know.
So the maras are fear of death, a false conception of self. Like we essentially, from the Tibetan perspective, we're this continuous changing body of emotions and ideas and discriminations. And we decide that this is a me, and that I have to protect this me. So the conception of self, the strong emotions called kleshas, which we've been talking about today, and being attracted to the bliss of meditation. So let's say you have that momentary experience of the clear mind, and then you say, oh, I want that every time I meditate. And then the next time you meditate, it's not there, and you go, oh, I'm a bad meditator. So grasping to the bliss of meditation is the fourth mara. And then we were talking about when you're immersed in the kleshas, or the strong emotions, what is really difficult about getting yourself out of it. The first is recognizing on the spot when you're in the middle of it. Like, we're really good at recognizing afterwards, oh, I really shouldn't have yelled at my boss. We know afterwards when we've done something wrong, right? Oh, I'm in trouble now. So in the middle of it, to recognize something's going on, to stop it while it's going on, and to cut it at the root. Those are the classic three difficulties.
Three A's, be friendly.
I added the fourth one because I find that hard, is to be friendly towards yourself so that you can engage in this.
Hardest part, because when I started thinking about when you had us do our 1 minute of thinking about the pattern,
mm-hmm.
I became immediately exhausted. Like, I wanted to lie down on my back. And I realized the amount of friendliness that it would take to actually to work on that.
Yeah.
And part of that, I think, goes back to I can't remember what term this was, but the notion that what our life is versus our expectations of what it should be. So there was a lot of feeling for me of shame of like, I can't believe it. I can't believe I've perpetrated this for so long.
Yeah.
Which, if I don't bring enough friendliness, then it'll just continue. But to develop that friendliness is really important, to be able to even just look at it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a more difficult process than imagined.
I think to me that was the key information that changed my life. The idea that we could, instead of being angry with ourselves, be friendly and curious. To me, I when I first heard that, you know, I think I always had a lot of anger about not being able to reach my ideal, or shame. I don't know how I would identify the complex series of emotions of not living up to my ideal and what that meant to me. But to the idea that, well, we can be friendly to ourselves. You know, and that it's no different than a little kid in a nightmare that you just want to gently, you know, rub their back and say, wake up. You know, that kind of friendliness to ourselves instead of shame.
That word friendly to me is very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I've always been stuck with, you know, I don't love myself.
Mm-hmm.
Love is, you know, it's hard, it's a strong emotion, it seems so But
yes.
friendliness has all these degrees.
Yes.
And you could just smile at people, and that's a friendly gesture. You
yes.
could smile at yourself. It's not as hard sometimes as
yes.
love, which is
yes.
hard. So friendly, you know, I'm going to really take that
yes.
away today.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
It's a real key. Well, really, the brilliant work in this area is coming from Pema Chodron, Sigur Kantor Rinpoche, and Joko Beck. So, to me, it's freeing for everybody. Yeah.
Kimola, is there a book that are there books that you can recommend? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Into this?
Yes. Joko Beck has two books. I don't remember the titles of her books, but one of Pema, all of Pema's books are good, but you can imagine, Go to the Places That Scare You.
Oh,
right.
Oh yeah.
That's the one that has the most about this, because this is it, going to that place that mm-hmm. scares you. Mm-hmm. And then Zigur Khandro Rinpoche's book, It's Up to You. So I think he did some of the groundbreaking work of it, explaining what Chempa is, that impulse. And I don't know, I really think it's one of the keys to addiction. I don't know how many people are working with different kinds of addictions. You can identify, I can feel it. I'm in the stage with addiction of recognizing it as it happens. I recognize as I'm reaching for the chocolate. I'm not stopping the chocolate, I'm not yanking my hand away yet. But I can feel that subtle little, yeah, that funny kind of feeling of being uncomfortable and wanting something sweet. Yeah. Chocolate is going to lead to my enlightenment, I'm convinced of it.
That's the story I really wanted to hold to, I think.
Yeah. What were you going to ask?
I'm not real clear on this, other than that I'm aware, at least in my own perception of people in the world today, that underlying anxiety that we all experience just because I think we know we're going to die someday or whatever is only expanded because of all events and wars and or social paths in the world and all this kind of stuff. And so it's hard for people to cope with that fear base that keeps getting thrown at us. Now we should worry about bird flu, but nobody around us is anywhere near it.
Yeah.
I think we're being, you know, like brainwashed to be afraid or something. You know what I mean?
We
are. It's a control.
Yes, absolutely
bombarded.
We are. Yeah. I mean, look at the weather. You know how they start tracking a blizzard a week ahead?
right.
So you will turn into that TV station to watch their weather report. Yeah, that's very interesting. So just recognizing when different kinds of emotions arise and allowing yourself to touch base with that open space in some form, whether it's just through breathing or say, oh, I'm getting caught up in fear.
Right.
Fear of bird flu. Fear of
I haven't
blizzard.
Got that yet, but I mean,
that's all for you. I mean, it could be anything.
But I hear
also.
It.
Yeah. When one of the things that I'm really concerned about, that I find really tremendously interesting, is how wired we all are now.
Right.
So how there is escape from our minds so continuously pervasive that it makes it more difficult, especially for the kids who are growing up now, to actually sit on their cushion for a minute or two, because we're so used to being plugged into something that's rapidly keeping our attention shifting, as opposed to, you know, as you know from what we experienced with meditation for the first 5 minutes, meditation is allowing your mind to focus on something instead of being distracted. So I wanted to tell you one more thing, that the kind of mindfulness that we want to get so that we can see what's arising as it arises is it's a story from Shantideva. It's the story is, there was a man who was a convict who was supposed to be executed, and so the king said, if you can take this bowl of oil, like imagine if this was filled to the brim with this bowl of oil, And if you can walk around the marketplace three times without spilling a drop. So you can imagine holding it, you know, and imagine like the incredible intention. It would save your life if you could walk with it without spilling a drop. That's the kind of mindfulness we would like. So then if you can see, even in 5 minutes, that it's not so easy just to focus on a simple thing like your breath, which is neutral, without seeing your mind going back and forth and, you know, all the millions of things we think about. So this is why we practice meditation. We practice meditation so that we can understand what our mind is doing moment to moment. If we can understand what our mind is doing moment to moment, then we're more likely, when we're caught off base, you know, and going into jealousy or depression or anger, any of those things, or addiction, we're more likely to be able to see it. If we have no training in watching our mind and understanding what our mind is doing, then we're like a leaf blowing in the wind. Whatever way the wind is going is where your mind is. Yeah.
I'm recently reading a book called Destructive Emotions.
Huh.
Dalai Lama and Daniel Goleman. And
yes.
And one of the things that that I'm realizing, or that they talk about in the book, is that the Eastern or Buddhist definition of the mind is much broader than the Western.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we sort of are brought up to think, well, you have mind, you have body, you have emotions, you know. And can you talk just a little bit about that around when you use mind, it's a little bit different than...
Well, an easy way to think about it is the location of the mind in the Buddhist perspective is at the heart. So that there isn't a separation between heart and mind. You know, all the different kinds of mental events would all be mind. That's a simple way of explaining it. What I like about this particular practice is that it's something that you can do. So some of the enlightened masters that I've heard talk are wonderful, and they give, you know, extraordinary teachings about our capacity. But one of the things I love about Pema Chodron is, you know, a few action steps that an ordinary person can do. So I think of her, she's sort of like a big sister, you know, who says, you know, and this is the way you get your driver's license. You know, she gives the in-between steps that really lead to the direct experience that the masters are talking about. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, when I was working on my dissertation, I had all this time to process, so I felt anxious. Well, let's just stop and see what I'm anxious about. And, and I started with my emotions. I was depressed, and then under the depression was sadness. Then under the next thing was anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I found I had this free-floating anxiety running around looking for something to worry about. And of course, it knows us really well, so it can pick, you know, what we're most vulnerable to.
Yes.
And unfortunately now, you know, I grab for the food and I don't feel comfortable with the anxiety. But at that time, you know, I could just say, oh, that's just my anxiety running around trying to find something to worry about. So the rest of my life, I'm trying to get back to that spot.
You know, this is interesting, and this leads us into my project, actually, because, you know, when I first started talking to people about why we're starting a monastery in this day and age, you know, on the one hand, half the people I worked with thought, oh, maybe she's gone off the deep end. Becoming a nun is, you know, considered a little crazy these days. And what I'm finding is, essentially, we're creating a context to do this kind of exploration. So my experience in the monastery is that it is creating an environment that totally supports seeing how your mind works, making it very easy, and that's your job while you're there. So we see, in this day and age, a monastery having a kind of permeable membrane. So there'd be some people like me for whom it's a life choice. There are other people who would come in for a short period of time and then take it out to the rest of their lives and their professions. And one of the things that I found most touching, I went back to Gampo Abbey to teach a youth retreat, and there were all these young kids, you know, who were, you know, on the computer, they had the iPods, they were doing all these things, and for a month they committed to sitting in silence. to totally sitting in silence. There were 2 weeks of absolute silence, and they were meditating 9 hours a day. And that's hard. That's really, really hard to go from, you know, teenage wildlife to sitting in practice. And we would have interviews with each of them, and they would be in tears. Because they were between 15 and 25. You know, and I think, oh, sure, I've got lots of experiences I can be upset about. But at 15, there was some wound that was so painful that they were afraid to face. And I thought, gee, if somebody had given me these skills at 15, wouldn't that have been great? If somebody could have just shown me that there was nothing in my mind to be afraid of at 15, you know, what a great skill to take into life. And so I see, you know, the purpose of setting up a monastery, you know, or a, in our case, a nunnery, really to create that context that then, you know, we can offer the fruits of our practice like this. I've learned this from being in a monastery, and I think it will help other people. And we can invite other people to come in for periods of time to say, I'm going to, you know, just like I'm going to learn science or I'm going to learn mathematics, I'm going to learn my mind this month.
And where will it be?
Vermont.
Okay.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Not so far away. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's been so nice spending the afternoon with you and talking about these things. And, you know, I really hope that it becomes as useful for you or even partially useful for you as it has been for me. So we'll just close again by taking a minute and just expressing the thought that this kind of peace of mind, this open spaciousness, may it go out to all beings.